Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, everyone. I'm Harvey Brownstone, and today's guest is a highly acclaimed director, screenwriter, producer, author, and educator whose feature film credits include Scott Joplin, Heroes, The Big Fix, The Chosen, which won 3 jury prizes at prestigious international film festivals, The Sting 2, The Journey of Natty Gann, which was the first American film to win a gold prize at the Moscow Film Festival, Golda's Balcony, and the exceptionally powerful and compelling movie entitled Shot, which is a must-see film about gun violence in America. Some of my favorite of his TV movies are Catherine, Courage, Descending Angel, Conspiracy, The Trial of the Chicago 8, which won an ACE Award for Best Dramatic Special, Rosewell, The UFO Cover-Up, which got a Golden Globe Award nomination for Best TV Movie, Color of Justice, Bobby's Girl, and Crown Heights, which earned him the Directors Guild of America Robert B. Aldrich Achievement Award and a nomination for Outstanding Directorial Achievement in Children's Programs, and for which he won an NAACP Image Award and the Humanitas Award for Affirming the Dignity of Every Person. He also produced and directed the internationally acclaimed 10-part TV series entitled The ACLU Freedom Files, which won a special recognition award at the Washington Independent Film Festival. In addition, he's directed dozens of TV shows, including Columbo, Picket Fences, Chicago Hope, for which he won an Emmy Award for Outstanding Directing, Ally McBeal, Family Law, The West Wing, for which the Online Film and Television Association nominated him for Best Direction of a Drama Series, and he directed the pilot for Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman. This man's contributions to the film industry have been monumental. He created the Change-Making Media Lab, which fosters positive social and environmental change by producing award-winning films dealing with pressing social issues. He served as the artistic director of Robert Redford's Sundance Lab, and he's been on the National Board of the Directors Guild, where he is chairperson of its special projects, providing members with educational, cultural, and technological information. Our guest is also an accomplished author. His books, entitled Directors Close Up, Volumes 1, 2, and 3, contain fascinating interviews with renowned film directors. He also wrote a mesmerizing and inspirational book about his near-death experience called My Death, A Personal Guidebook. And he's written an interactive e-textbook called Keys to Directing. He's a professor at the USC School of Cinematic Arts, and he's taught master classes on filmmaking throughout the world. He's a member of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, the Television Academy, the Writers Guild, and the Directors Guild. I'm delighted and very honored to welcome the brilliant and mega-talented Jeremy Kagan to our show. Jeremy, thank you so much for being here.
It is more than my pleasure. It's my intimidation with all of those numbers. Now I understand why I have a white beard.
Well, you know, Jeremy, when I look at the subject matter of your films, it's clear that you are very much guided by social justice. Your movies have dealt with every major issue like racism, gay rights, gun violence, women's health, teen parenthood, political activism, substance abuse. What drives your creativity as a filmmaker?
Well, you know, I think it's parental influence to start with, meaning that both of my parents felt that as human beings, their responsibility was to be able to, I'll just put this word right, make a difference and make the world better. And so growing up with that as a sort of framework, the idea of what you do if you can do something that strives for good and potentially helps other human beings, then that's a worthy life. And my sort of, when I started to become a filmmaker, the people that were inspiring me were also filmmakers who had that same intention, that they not only wanted to entertain us and tell us stories that we got interested in and with characters we cared about, but they also wanted to take on issues. So whether it was Sergei Eisenstein, who was this very famous Russian filmmaker in the 20s and all through the 40s, and in fact, I wrote my college thesis about him taking on real political issues of fairness and who should control the state, to contemporary artists, both as visual artists as well as a moving picture artist, taking on social issues, which I feel is a responsible way of being a filmmaker. One of the things that I teach at the School of Cinematic Arts is called Media for Social Change, where our students are literally saying, what issues do you care about and how can you use cinema to either get people aware of the issue or potentially to get people to change their own behavior. So this has always been part of my motivation.
If you're a coffee lover like me, it's always fun to discover a great new blend. I recently found a terrific new company, Breakfast at Dominique's, that's created a series of coffee blends to honor the legacies of the greatest Hollywood legends. And I'm thrilled to tell you that now, Breakfast at Dominique's has introduced the Harvey Brownstone Talk Show Blend. It's my very own exclusive, delicious, bold, rich, balanced, medium roast coffee, and I just know you're going to love it. It's made from high quality organic beans produced using fair trade practices. If you'd like a great cup of coffee, give Breakfast at Dominique's a try and order the Harvey Brownstone Talk Show Blend at HollywoodBlends.com. They'll ship it right to your door anywhere in the world. Sipping our coffee is the perfect way to watch our show. So aside from Sergei Eisenstein, were there other role models and major influences as a young filmmaker?
I was not one of these kids who wanted to make films at the age of five. When I was young, that really wasn't something you could do as easily as we can do now. Obviously, just picking up a cell phone, you can. I sort of grew into admiring filmmaking much later. So part of my education in film was a lot influenced by the evolution of European films. So I was seeing, when I was beginning to sort of get interested in filmmaking and studying it, there was the Nouvelle Vague, the French filmmakers, which included people like Truffaut and Godard. There were, in fact, the Italian neorealists like Fellini. So these were the image makers that were really exciting me. And I had, by the way, no idea that they were all under the influence of incredible American filmmakers. I just didn't know this. I mean, I had maybe seen, a Hitchcock film and gotten terrified, but I hadn't, I didn't know who Capra was or John Ford, for those of you who know these people. And suddenly when I came out, first of all, studied in New York at the graduate school at NYU studying film, still with the intention of being, because the only thing I was really interested in was animation, because I draw, I'm a graphic artist, and I thought I would work for this new company called the Children's Television Workshop, which became Sesame Street. But then I got a fellowship to something called the American Film Institute, and some of these masters were still alive. And they actually came to the American Film Institute and talked to us. And I suddenly realized, geniuses in American filmmaking. All these Europeans were under the influence of these American filmmakers, and people like Capra making these amazing movies that also had real social, relevance. Looking at, for example, right now, if you look at Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, we all should watch that almost weekly, just to remind ourselves of the danger of corruption within leadership and our responsibility. And it's a great movie. So I suddenly realized that, we come as Americans, filmmakers, from this great history of also really social relevant, but very entertaining movies. So that sort of puts me where I am.
And it all makes sense when you look at what you've done with the influences that you've absorbed. Now, I think you know, Jeremy, that I used to be a family and criminal court judge, right?
Yes.
Well, one of the reasons I very much wanted to interview you is because in 1974, you directed a wonderful TV movie called Unwed Father, about a teenage boy who fathers a child with his girlfriend and then goes to court to try to get custody. That film was shown when I was in law school, and it motivated me to go into family law. So I want to thank you for that.
You've probably just made my day, because if I, as another human being, can influence another to do good things, which obviously you've done, then you feel sort of justified. You feel like, you know, your life has some meaning. And it's fascinating. Yesterday, we were celebrating a memorial for Larry Terman, who was the producer of that particular movie for television. He gave me that as my very first movie for television, which was an incredibly gift in a way, because as you know, talking to other filmmakers, careers are very challenging and difficult, and they're roller coaster rides, and sometimes, you know, a door opens and everything changes. And that particular movie was from Larry Terman, this wonderful producer, open the door for me to be able to make my first movie of the week. And I remember, by the way, I had a great experience on this movie. I'll tell you a quick one. I'd never worked with, I was a guy who had long hair and lots of it, and I was not part of Hollywood at all. And I'd never done any stunt work. And there was this moment when I had sort of, you know, as any director does, you sort of do some writing changes in the script to potentially make it more powerful in terms of how you want to tell the story. And there was as you may remember, the boy is so frustrated that he gets on his motorcycle because he's losing this effort to try to be the father of this child. And he gets on his motorcycle, and I had him speed away. And I had been a motorcycle rider, and I'd had an accident, and I remember that. It wasn't so much that I was as careless as our hero was, but I thought that was a good idea. And we started to stage this scene because I was going to have him sort of slide off the motorcycle as some car came by him. But the stuntman, I didn't know this, now I know, wanted to do something spectacular. So instead of sliding, he actually rammed the motorcycle into the car, went flying over the car and crashing onto the sidewalk. I thought, is this guy alive? And there were lots of teenage kids watching it who were making fun of the movie making anyway. I remember saying to everybody, nobody move, nobody move. And I, you know, went over to him and looked at him, and he was sort of like, I'm okay. And I said, all right, let's, you know, and we immediately had him sent off to check that he was okay, and he was okay. But I realized you really have to be very clear about what you want to have on your film, because certain people may take it to an extreme that is not either safe or, in fact, what you needed in the movie. Yeah, I remember that particular learning lesson at the moment of clarity of what you want, particularly in stunts.
Well, I must say that movie impacted an entire generation of family law lawyers. It's still as relevant today as it was then, which is true of most of your movies, I have to say, including Chaim Potok's The Chosen. You directed the film adaptation of that book, You worked with him on the screenplay. What's it like working with an author adapting his book into your movie?
Well, actually, in this particular case, first of all, the book was brilliant. It was a strange thing. You know, every now and then, and you probably know this in your own life, and I'm sure some of the people who are watching this know this as well. Sometimes things want you to do them. You may not want to do them, but things want you to do them. And I had been offered this script 2 years before, actually, I was offered again. And I had read it, and I didn't think it was a very good script. So I had said no. And then 2 years later, these brilliant producers, the Landaus, Edie and Eli, sent me a script, said they want me to do this. And they actually had two genius actors, Rod Steiger and Maximilian Schell, committed to it. Would I direct it? And I had enormous respect for these producers. And so I start reading the script and I said, I've read this before. Why are they, this isn't a very good script. What's going on here? So I went out and bought the book. I'm a slow reader. It took me 2 days to read it. And after reading it, I realized it was an absolute masterpiece. And I said, oh, this just needs to be rewritten. So I actually, although I spoke to Chaim, and Chaim was very helpful in getting us into the Brooklyn Hasidic Jewish community in order to be, for me to be able to do the research I needed to do to be able to make the movie. But essentially at that moment, Chaim's only real participation in the movie was I asked him to, in fact, play a role. And there's Chaim there. He plays a teacher in the movie. And that's me when I had some hair. And when the movie was done, because I rewrote it from the book, of course, Chaim said, I think one of the most, made me always feel good, and I like to be able to retell this. He said, you know, my book has been translated into 30 languages, and this is probably the best translation so far.
And wow.
That made me feel good about that movie.
Oh, for sure. When you direct a movie that you also wrote, does Jeremy Kagan, the director, ever get into conflict with Jeremy Kagan, the writer?
It's always a good question, because how you look at a script that stimulates you, in fact, if it's stimulating, I think if you think the script is perfect, and there's no perfect script, then why not hand the script out to everybody at home or in the theater and let them read it? What's the point of making a movie if the script is that good? If you look at scripts as evolutionary, meaning that it is the foundation, without it there's nothing, of course, but it is the foundation for something to grow, to something to change. So when you put, like over here, you put Rod Steiger in the movie, it's a different movie than the script was. So that you're making the movie, as some people have said, four times. It's obviously made when it's written. But then when you cast it, it's a different movie. It's changed. And then when you're in the process of shooting, things continually change. Things change because you're learning that, oh, you know, maybe there should be an emphasis over here on this scene. Maybe we should change this piece of dialogue. I remember in this particular movie, Chaim in the book had written this amazing speech that the father has with his son. And it's just a beautiful piece of writing, and it's four pages. There's no way you're going to do a four-page scene in, you know, of dialogue in a movie. And I remember I kept writing and rewriting it while we were shooting. And in fact, the day before, I rewrote it again and gave it to Rod nervously, because he would have to now memorize new lines. And Rod, being who he is as a master actor, was able to, you know, do it, take it. So it kept changing. I remember, by the way, the end of my, just another example of that idea, the end of my first feature film, which was called Heroes, it starred the new star Henry Winkler and Sally Field and a strange new actor named Harrison Ford, and no one had ever heard of him. Anyway, there was a scene at the end of the movie between these two characters. And it was a dialogue scene where the hero is sort of gone almost crazy, and the heroine wants to save him, wants to keep him from being self-destructive. And there was a long dialogue that was there. It was well written and gone through, as some Hollywood projects do, a number of writers, and it was there. And I remember while we were driving to the location, I kept thinking about this, and I suddenly said, you know what? None of these words are right. And I took the two actors, who were wonderful actors and creative and had the capacity to do improvisation, which not all, a lot of actors can do well, but these two can. And I literally gave them what we call an intentional direction. I said to Henry, Henry, destroy yourself. Sally, stop him. Those are both intentional things. No dialogue given to them at all. I had two cameras rolling. We went and shot this, and it was sort of amazing, but I was so nervous because it was new. So I asked my editor, his name was Kennedy, I asked him, would you put that scene together? Because I don't know if it's even going to work. It's the end of the movie. And he did. And again, this idea of how things happen unexpectedly. As he's driving back to the studio, he hears this song called Wayward Son, and he puts that song to the end of the movie, to this non-dialogue scene that once was a dialogue scene. And it was magical. I remember crying when I saw that particular thing. We were still shooting. And that movie was a big commercial success, my first movie. But that ending was something that evolved. hadn't intended. And as I said, you make it four times: writing, casting, shooting, and editing, as I was just talking about. So as a director, you're always in the process of recognizing how things may change to make them more effective, more emotionally evocative. And that's what's wonderful about that is you have to be very present. You're very alive because you're not just doing what was in the script. You're making it. You're developing it. You're creating potentially something that will be even surprising and more pleasing to whoever the writers are than when they saw it just on a page.
Wow, what a gift you have to bring a script to life like that. Now, in 1986, you directed a TV movie based on a true story called Courage, which is about a mother played by Sophia Loren who discovers that her son is a drug addict. So she becomes an undercover cop to eliminate drug trafficking in her neighborhood. What was it like working with the fabulous Sophia Loren?
Well, here is the thing. I was totally sort of, when I was a kid, unlike some of my contemporaries who, I'll say, maybe I'll use this word, lusted after this stunning woman, I was totally like intimidated, using the word, that word again. I mean, it was like she was this goddess over there. Like, how could I even talk to her? And all of a sudden I'm getting this job, and it's a good script, and it's about an issue that I do care about, which is the issue of drug addiction and how one handles it, and particularly the people who profit from it. So I wanted to make this film, but the only thing I did was I direct her? I mean, she'd been directed by some of the greatest directors in the world, like De Sica, and made masterpieces like Two Women. Whoa, could I? How? So I remember the only thing I did was I had a phone call with her before we were going to go to the locations where we're going to make the movie. And I thought she was mostly concerned in the phone call about her hair, because her hair had been so many changed in so many ways that oftentimes she would wear different kinds of things, different wigs or whatever it is. And I thought, oh my goodness, if she's just concerned with her image, what are we going to do? And I was very nervous. And I arrive at the hotel where we're both staying, and she's got the big penthouse suite, and she invites me up. And the door opens, and here's this woman who's kind of wearing a schmata. She's just got sort of like this sort of unflattering dress on. And she says to me, Jeremy, would you like a cappuccino? Espresso? Now, I at that time had no idea what that even was. Is it espresso or espresso? I had no idea. I said, sure. Oh, no, I make you an espresso. She makes this thing. Of course, it gets me wired all the rest. And I realize she is just one of the most open, giving, generous, loving, imaginative people I've ever met. And I remember she said something that I want to, this is a wonderful quote that she said about, that Sika said to her, and it's a good one for all of us, because I learned a lot from her. And she said, you know, I had my jewelry stolen once, and I was very upset, and I was very crying. And De Sica, this famous Italian director who really sort of discovered her as an actress, said to her, don't ever cry over something that can't cry over you. So I learned a lot from Sophia.
That is actually very powerful.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Well, one of your most interesting movies, Jeremy, is Descending Angel, about a man who discovers that his future father-in-law may have been a Nazi collaborator and a mass murderer. And it starred George C. Scott, who had a reputation for being quite difficult. What was he like?
It was an interesting experience, and it's something that I often recommend to my students now when we're making a movie. I say, talk to other directors who've worked with the actor you're about to work with. So you get an idea of, you know, who they are, what they've done. And I remember sort of talking to a number of directors, Arthur Hiller in particular, who did Love Story. And Arthur said to me, and did a movie about a doctor that George was a star of, brilliant. And he said, understand something. He gets it right away. But if you ask him to do a retake and a retake for whatever reasons, he gets self-conscious. And then you're going to have a real sort of tension possibility, because he begins to judge himself and then projects that on you. So no, he's going to get it right, but don't do lots of takes. And it was a great piece of advice. And there was one time when I needed to do lots of takes, and that was that great confrontational moment when the actor looks at the director and goes, "You're not doing this again, are you? You're not doing this again, are you? George, I know it's a complex shot. Please just one more take. If we don't, we'll do something else. We'll do some coverage." Silence. Stare. Does it brilliantly. But here's to his credit. He had to have an accent in it, and Romanian. And I wanted him to also be able to sing a little bit of a song. So I sent him the song. And I didn't know if he was going to do this or not. And he could have said, "Look, is it necessary?" And he totally committed it. He had it. He had the accent. He had everything. So, you know, when you work with artists that have such capacity, they're giving you a gift, and you need to recognize it. And George is that kind of, you know, master.
Yeah, and I think you're that kind of master director, that you understand the psychology and even a bit of the pathology that's involved when an insecurity surfaces, only because you've asked them to do it again for legitimate reasons, but it impacts them in a way that's going to be toxic.
The one thing you don't want actors to do is to be self-conscious. You want actors, and you know from a good interview, when you feel that person is present, that they're not sort of like quoting what they've all done, and I'm sure I'm doing some of that, but that they're right here, they're right now, which means that they're not observing themselves. That's your job. You're a director. Your job is to observe them and to help them give a better performance if you can do that. Their job is to be in the moment of that performance. And sort of to know that is really important. So oftentimes, if you're asking them to do it over and over and over again, that they're suddenly getting self-conscious. Now, talking to so many directors, because I've talked to literally interviewed hundreds of the greatest directors in the world. And things, I remember talking to David Fincher about Social Network and doing take over, take over, take. And one of the things that David said is it exhausts the actors in a way, so that finally they're just sort of, they have no choice but to be present, because they've been saying these lines 15, 20, 30, 50 times. It's like, just saying the lines, whatever it is. And there's a naturalism that suddenly emerges because they're no longer acting. They're just doing it. So that was a reason for that. Whereas other directors like Clint Eastwood, Clint is very, very clear about this to his actors. He says, "I'm going to give you one take. I cast you. You're a good actor. So we're just going to do one take," which means you have to give your A game right away. So sort of understanding these differences, and Guillermo del Toro, I really was fascinated once talking about directing, and Guillermo was saying, "You know, look, I have to play lots of roles. Sometimes I have to be a friend. Sometimes I have to be a father. Sometimes I have to be very strict. And sometimes I have to be really collaborative and loose." And he said, and then he said, "You have to understand something. I come from a culture where we play lots of roles, so it was easy for me to do that. Sometimes it's tougher for me. I'm not the kind of belligerent guy, although every now and then I will get firm if indeed I see that there's a laziness happening, because that's not what you want. You want that excitement, that energy, that presence, that spontaneity, that moment of we're here doing this." And by the way, it's for any director you've talked about, those are the moments that are magical, because you don't quite know what's going to happen. So you too, as a director, have to be incredibly aware. And one of the things I teach to my students is I say, there are a number of things I want you to learn no matter what you do. I want you to learn to see better than you see now. And I want you to learn to hear better than you hear now. And everybody's sort of like, "What does that mean?" And then I give them examples where they don't see what's literally what's in front of them. And so it's a fascinating thing, because when you're good at this, as I've talked to some masters who really are good at this, you know they're so focused and they're so present. And at that moment, they have the miracle of what life really is about, which is right here, right now.
Yeah, this is just fascinating. And let me assure you, Jeremy, I can sense that you're very present. Very present right here, right now. Now, when I mentioned to a number of friends that you were coming on the show, the one movie that came to everybody's lips was By the Sword, which is about fencing. It's a huge classic cult film. Are you surprised that that movie became such a cult classic?
Totally. My bigger surprise, though, I want to tell you, is something else. I made a movie called Big Man on Campus. And Big Man on Campus is a comedy, and it's a very funny comedy. In fact, it's just about to finally be, quote, re-released as a DVD. And the interesting thing is, in one's life as a filmmaker, and I had thought that filmmaking life, like the staircase way behind us, is like, you know, everything goes like that. Well, that's not true. Life is like this. And so is your filmmaking career like that. And when I made that movie, Big Man on Campus, people who saw it when we tested it said, this movie is going to change your career, Jeremy, because it's incredibly funny. Yes, it's sophomoric. It's for you know, sort of teenagers, but it works. And when we tested it, it was, you know, getting all kinds of laughs. In fact, the day after we tested it, they said, we're going to do a sequel. But what happened in the evolution of this particular company is they ran out of money and they couldn't distribute it. And what I thought was going to be a very popular movie is an underground movie. And it is a kind of underground classic in terms of comedies, because lots of college kids know about this movie and watch it because it's pretty funny. And you can watch it in various stages of consciousness and have some good laughs and good times. By the Sword, you know, was a movie that was kind of a challenge to make. And in the end, you know, it just didn't get distributed. So it sort of like disappeared. Although I got to tell you, I think it's got one of the best posters I've seen. I wish I had a picture of that to put in the background, but I don't. So I'll put Conspiracy instead.
Oh, well, that was a great one. Now, one of your most powerful films, Jeremy, which is from 1997, but feels even more current and applicable today than it did back then, is Color Justice, which is about the impact of racism in the criminal justice system. Given everything that's happened in recent years, including the George Floyd murder and the Black Lives Matter movement, would you change anything about Color Justice if you were making that movie today?
Well, I'm sure I would, because you always, you know, there's always something that you could say just as an artist. Look, there's a moment when you let things alone, when they have to live on their own. There's a phrase my father used to say when I was doing drawings, and he says, these are a couple of drawings on my back behind me, and he would say, don't potchkey. Now, potchkey is a phrase which means you keep doing it, you keep fiddling with it, it's done, let it alone. Now let it have its own life. And if it's going to want to have that life, it is. So with any of these movies, what was really, I had to really struggle in this movie for its ending, because this is a movie about, obviously, prejudice against specifically Black people. I mean, that's what the story is really about. And it's these kids, and these kids unintentionally get involved in a killing. And there's this trial and everything that happens in terms of the politicalness of this trial. But I was interested in getting this emotional connection for the audience. And I was insisting that one of our characters, played by Dulé Hill, it was, I think, his first job, and he's since become a very, very successful actor. Fabulous dancer, by the way. In the movie, we had another great dancer, and they both would tap in between scenes. That was Gregory Hines, and here were these two guys tapping in the background. But I wanted him to be, in fact, also killed. And the studio and the producers were saying, no, that shouldn't. And I said, no, you need to have this happen so that the audience too sees the horrible twists and consequences of bigotry and bias and prejudice. And, you know, it worked in the movie. It was a very powerful emotional piece. So more, it was struggling to get the movie then to represent the ideas that I felt needed to be put out, rather than looking at now. But it still, I think, is appropriate, particularly in the conversations we are going to continually have in dealing with DEI.
Well, I don't know if I'm going to make your day again, but in my last 2 years as a judge, I taught law at a community college, and I played Color Justice to my students because I felt it was that important. It was that impactful You know, drama has the ability to convey key messages in a way that reading something doesn't.
It's true.
And you are, you, sir, are quite a master. And another, if I hope you don't mind me listing some of these favorite movies of mine, but I just can't resist. So let me go to 2002. You directed another one of my all-time favorites, a beautiful film called Bobby's Girl, starring Bernadette Peters and Rachel Ward, about a lesbian couple who take in one of their nephews. What drew you to that project?
Interestingly enough, the person that was running the Showtime at the time, now I made a couple movies for them. I'd made Roswell, which was very, very successful for them. He came to me, if I remember the timing here, and said, would you direct this? And it was written by Sam Bernstein, who wanted to direct it himself. And I remember this moment, and it was a very powerful moment. We met, and I could see that Sam was very emotional about this, and he had created this, and I wanted him to know that I wanted to be as respectful, talking about what we were talking about earlier, to his intentions in this script, so that I would be a translator. It's an interesting word. Steven Spielberg, every now and then, Steven has used that word. He says, you know, well, that's what I do. I don't originate, which of course is not true, but he's saying, you know, I'm translating it into another media. And I wanted him to know that I was committed to doing that. And I felt like his heart opened up enough to say and feel that my heart was open to what he intended. We made this movie in Ireland, which was sort of an incredible, delightful experience to be there. But I just remember talking about acting. I've made a number of movies with kids in them. One of my favorite movies is you know, The Journey of Nanny Gad, and that has this young 14-year-old girl as the star of it. And there was this moment when, because this sort of stands out to me, there was this moment in the other movie, Bobby's Girl, where I needed to get this little boy, who now also has become a very successful actor, but this was one of his first things, to actually be emotionally affected and potentially, quote, cry. So I'm looking at all these ways as a director to get this kid who's never acted before really to get into a place where he's going to cry. And I'm telling him sort of the story itself and getting him potentially emotionally involved and asking about when he's been upset as a kid and trying to see if I can get this sense memory thing. And finally, he looks up at me and says, do you just want me to blubber? And I go like, yeah. Oh, and he starts crying.
Sometimes it's that simple.
Yep. It's just, you know, for me, it takes a lot to get to tears. For some people like that, they're there.
Now, of course, I have to ask you about Crown Heights, which is a fabulous movie about an Orthodox rabbi and a community activist who help a young Hasidic Jew and a young Black man form a hip hop group to heal their neighborhood after a major riot. This is the movie that proved, at least to me, that Howie Mandel can actually act. How did you get such a great performance out of him?
Actually, you know, first of all, Howie can. Oftentimes, by the way, people who are, and I've seen this a number of times, certain people who are natural comedians can actually play a serious role. That transition is not as difficult as it is for some people who are wonderful, sort of, I'll call them tragedians or dramatic actors, to ask them to, quote, be funny. As Rob Reiner once said, you can't make somebody be funny. There's a kind of thing that's inside in terms of their own timings. You're just not going to train somebody to do that. So in a way, going from Howie's comic abilities, because he's a good stand-up comic as well, to be able to go to from that into being able to, if you will, just go into a serious role wasn't that difficult for him. And Howie really committed to it. And we had Marion Van Peebles Jr. playing opposite him. And Mario and he really liked each other and stimulated each other to really give, if you will, better performances together. So, you know, I really respected both of them in terms of making a commitment. And that movie is sort of a significant movie in many ways. For those of you who don't know about it, in 1991, there was a hot summer and two communities, one very Orthodox Jewish community and the other much more Black Caribbean, they live across the street from each other. They went into violent conflict for 3 days. And the effort of the community leaders to get the kids to meet each other and talk to each other and say, you know, why do you wear those funny hats? You know, and why do you guys wear all those weird sneakers? And to play together, literally to play basketball together, and to realize that, in fact, there's a commonality for all of us. And I really think the power of that movie, going through that experience of realizing that what you think are reasons to be over here and only like this can be dissolved when you get to know each other and realize you can be like that. So I was glad we made that movie.
Are you aware that your body of work is really an education in social justice, in human rights, in inclusivity? Do you get that? That you really, if they ever had a Jeremy Kagan Film Festival, it would be all of that and even an emotional education. It's really quite remarkable.
I think I'm very fortunate. First of all, I'm very fortunate that I got to be a filmmaker. I mean, just to be a filmmaker is in itself, you know, an amazing, it's just a gift. I mean, I look at all my students who all want their own careers, and I was lucky, and a lot of it is timing. I was there at the right time. But I've always pursued stories, if I can, like this one, Conspiracy of the Trial of Chicago 8, that really are about who we are as human beings, how we relate to each other, and what our responsibilities are, both to ourselves and the people we care about, and to the society we live in. And I feel that that's what we're all supposed to, that's why we're here. That's sort of the school. For some reason, we've been all sent down to the planet, and the school is, how do we actually create a kind of, I'll use the word, paradise here? How do we do it? And we certainly get in each other's way, if not our own way, all the time. And so that's, those stories fascinate me. And for example, I mean, the that series that we did about various rights, LGBTQ rights, women's rights, dissent, part of this ACLU series, and producer came to me because of the films I had made. And it was an amazing experience to sort of go around the country and see the struggles that all of us are having to be able to have essentially a world of fairness, which is, I think, every one of us, no matter what side of aisles we're on, believes in fairness. And to be asked to do that by others, because I've already done movies that deal with this, has been an honor. It's just an honor.
Well, it's an honor for us, the viewers, because you shift our attitudes, our behavior. I want to ask you about the film version of the one-woman play, Golda's Balcony, starring Valerie Harper. She just became invisible, totally transformed herself into Golda Meir. Tell me about that experience. That must have been, how do you take a one-woman show and turn it into a movie?
You try to be like this guy over here. That was when I was young. I just want to show you that I actually existed.
And that you actually had hair.
Exactly. Let's see if I can put it on me. Valerie, I went to see the play because I was asked if I would make a movie of it. And I saw the play, and it was in a theater with 5,000 people. And I was deeply, deeply moved. I mean, I just thought it was amazing. And when I went backstage, she remembered that we had worked together on a television show many, many, many years ago, and I had not remembered it. And we immediately connected. And I said, Valerie, I want to do something that honors what you've done in the theater, which, and there just is a difference between theater and film. I'm about to do a play. There's something about, as we all know, when you're in a room with a whole bunch of real people on a stage, accidents can happen. Who knows? You know, a chair can break. You know, somebody can forget their lines. That doesn't happen in a movie. We've controlled it. But there's that spontaneity, that immediacy. And I said to Valerie, I want to see if we can create that. And I don't want to do, you know, scenes and all. I want just you playing all these characters, which you do, and I will create behind you an environment. And so we shot the whole thing. For those of you who know this kind of stuff, it's like a CGI stuff. We shot the whole thing against a green screen and then took all the documentary footage from that time, which was the Yom Kippur War, that, of course, there was lots of this, and we molded it behind her in very, very creative ways so that you felt the history behind the presence of the human. And it's, in a way, kind of looking at an image here, that's history behind me. But what's real, or realer, if you will, we're on Zoom and virtual, is this. And so I wanted Valerie to be able to have that. And I just found her, you know, it's just so wonderful to work with incredibly talented actors who are and want to be directed. That's just magical, because, you know, they're so good. You know, I remember, again, talking about Steven Spielberg for a second. I remember Steven saying at the end of the Amistad, this amazing, amazing speech, and that he said, all I did was sit back and watch a great performance. I didn't do anything. And now, I don't know if that's true or not, but that sometimes is what we get. We get to be in the presence of people who are so talented that they make us feel something strong that we didn't even know we were doing. And Valerie's that kind of actor. So it was.
Oh, she sure was. And we all miss her terribly. Now, your most recent feature film is the incredibly powerful, highly relevant movie called Shot, about the impact on three people's lives of a single, simple gunshot. You co-wrote the movie with your wife and Will Lamborn. Tell me what inspired that story.
I've always wanted to deal with this issue of gun violence. I've always felt, even when I was young, I remember, you know, a neighbor. He was a teenager, I was like 6 or 7, and he shot himself. He killed himself with a rifle. And I've been lucky enough not to literally be around gun violence, but, you know, I've been making movies. I've killed people endlessly in movies. And there's this sort of sense of responsibility about, you know, is this very media encouraging the idea that unfortunately now has become, you know, an obsession in America with the use of guns. And I really feel that we as storytellers can potentially get people to be, as I said, more aware and maybe more responsible if they have guns, or maybe even more responsible to saying things like, you know, automatic weaponry belongs on the in the movie and on the battlefield, but not on your street, and not across the in the hands of a neighbor. And how, you know, when you look at, and this is sort of also some of the things we deal with when we teach media for social change, when you look at, and it becomes an issue, you look at the amount of gun violence in America, which is absurd. I mean, you take, you know, 20 other countries, put them together, and we still double, if not triple, the number of gun deaths every single year. Is this the America that we all want? Of course not. So how do we change? And I wanted to tell a story in which it could have been you. It's not that you live in a poor neighborhood, so, oh yeah, it's because of those people. And so I specifically wanted to tell the story, and here's Noah Wiley, you know, white guy, middle class, got a job, interesting enough, got a job in movies where he makes sound effects for sounds of guns going off. But the possibility of the experience of us identifying with a character, this could have been us. And what I wanted to do was essentially tell it in real time. And so the movie really is a movie in real time for its first two thirds, for that first hour. And apparently, if you've been shot and you can survive the gunshot within an hour's time, you probably will live. But here's the other question. How do you live? One of the things we don't talk about, we talk about all the numbers of people that get killed. What about all the people who now are walking wounded, literally, or not walking wounded and paralyzed? What about their stories? There are more of them, by the way, than there are the ridiculous number of 100,000 people being shot every year and killed. And I wanted us to experience that too. So that was the effort of this movie, to help, just to help us get into the conversation. We do not have to accept that our society is going to be the most violent society in the world. We don't we don't have to accept that. We can change it, but we can't turn our back on it. And that's why I was hoping this movie would be part of the conversation, that people would be able to say, you know, you should see that film, you know, get conscious of what happens when somebody gets shot. And when somebody gets shot, it's not just the person that gets shot, it's the people around them. It's the people that care for them. One bullet affects many, many lives. Anyway.
Well, I have to tell you, I hope everyone watching will see Shot. It's easily available on streaming platforms. And I have to tell you that it's interesting to me as a Canadian, you're talking about the impact you hope the movie has on your fellow Americans. But for those of us outside the United States, movies like Shot only mystify us even more because we can't understand why it's such a complicated thing to enact gun controls when we've always had them.
Yeah, it's true.
So do you have a favorite of all your movies?
No, I don't. You know, I feel that I've been lucky enough to make a number of movies that still affect me, that I can look at them and say, you know, This has an evocative nature to it. This has an emotional effect that may stimulate people to expand their own awareness. So I think I have ones that I like less, but I have some that I really am glad that I've been able to make them. So that's, and as I said, that's been a, well, it's been a gift, you know, to be able to make a movie that is about something that you care about. Listen, also, I often say this, and it's rare. I ask other directors this question: has any movie you've ever made changed your life? And this movie, The Chosen, changed my life, because I grew up almost like a secular religious world, and my father was what's called a Reform rabbi, but it's a very, very enlightened, sort of secular and non-dogmatic. And I knew really very little about the basic spiritual tenets of where I come from. I'm 3,000 years of a particular tribe of people. And when I made this movie, The Chosen, it exposed me to stuff that I knew nothing about. For example, there's something called Kabbalah, which is the spiritual basis of Judaism, and I didn't know anything about it. And now it is a daily practice of my life. I'm not part of this. There's a couple of things that are a little bit more, I don't know. And I'm not part of those centers. This is an actual personal practice taught to me by some really quite brilliant teachers. And it's meditative, it's healing, and it comes from where I come from. I wouldn't be here if it weren't for those people who did this for thousands of years, and I didn't know about it. But when I made the movie, I learned about it. And not only learned about it, I wanted to see, does this apply to me too? And I realized it did, and it has. So a movie that I made changed my life. And I talk about being grateful, major grateful.
Well, The Chosen, for those of us who grew up Jewish, The Chosen was a very important movie. It helped me understand why I am Jewish, what it means to be Jewish. Now, you mentioned that you often ask directors, have you made a movie that's changed your life? You've published 3 volumes of interviews with directors called Directors Close Up. Some of my favorites are your interviews with Paul Thomas Anderson, James Cameron, the Coen brothers, Martin Scorsese, Ron Howard, Ang Lee, Spielberg, Tarantino. What inspired you to begin interviewing directors?
Well, actually, it came up with, I was talking to Arthur Hiller, a director I just already mentioned. He was the president of the Directors Guild at the time. And Robert Wise, the great Robert Wise, had asked me to take over a division committee called Special Projects that provides all the educational, cultural events for our almost 20,000 members. And I was, of course, you know, incredibly complimented that Bob wanted me to be the next chair of that committee. And Arthur and I were talking, how could we, you know, what else could we do? And I said, why don't we do a symposium and interview the directors who have been nominated for Best Feature Film that year? And Arthur said, good idea, but who should do the, I said, I'll do it. Because I wanted to talk to them. And we started with the very first group. And these three books are almost 30 years of, I think, honestly, having read some wonderful books about directing by other people, both directors like John Badham's, or some terrific books about filmmaking. Actually, our friend Randall Kleiser, some wonderful drawing directors, has information of directors as well. But these are intense interviews about the process of directing, so that anybody as a new filmmaker or an experienced filmmaker can look up and say, well, how did Scorsese deal with sort of the issue of set design and production design? And open up the book, look it up, and there's Marty talking about how he did Gangs of New York or whatever in the particular movie, Wolf of Wall Street. So it really is been a gift to me. But what's been fascinating, and I think you're doing the same thing, is you know about the process. By knowing about the process, you're able to talk to people who do it, and they feel, oh, this is not just somebody who's asking from the outside. This is somebody who has been right there in the field doing the exact same things that we do and asking how we do it. And so there's this ease in conversation that has been in all of these interviews, which I think have made them probably the best collection of material about how directors do what they do. So I highly recommend it to anybody who's really, first of all, it's good storytelling too, but anybody who's into the process, I want to know more about how do you do it. Well, here are the masters, or there are the masters, telling you exactly how they do it. And it's been it's been incredible, because I've, you know, been able to then take what they've said and pass it on to my students. So, yeah.
Well, those three volumes are, as far as I'm concerned, part of the historical record. They're monumentally important because these people will not always be around, and you've encapsulated as best as anyone can the analysis of their craft in terms of a very practical how do they do it?
I want to talk something that you just said, because I think it's important. You just said something about the archival, if you will, nature of what this is, because that means, you know, here's, you know, Tarantino and Ang Lee and Barbra Streisand, and, you know, their process now is available for anybody to see. What I want to talk about is this conspiracy piece, because when I made this movie, I interviewed all, and being in the world of law, you know this, I interviewed for 2.5 hours every single one of the real defendants at the Chicago conspiracy trial. And you're actually seeing some of them over here. I mean, there's the real Bobby Seale right there. Tom Hayden is a little bit hidden over here, but there's Tom over there. And then right below me, in the down over here, is Abbie Hoffman. And I interviewed all of them. And this movie is a fascinating movie because you have actors playing them, as you see in this image behind me, and you have the real people. And they're interfacing in the movie, which made this movie quite special, quite different from many, many other kinds of movies. And what I did, though, was have all of these, you know, I might use a little clip of one of these interviews that was part of the movie, but I had these 2-hour interviews. And I realized that this was history. And what I did was I created a website, you can go to one, it's, you know, a conspiracy website, and actually, if you want to know who Abbie Hoffman or Tom Hayden are, you can hear them now talk about this time in their lives. And it feels so important that it's there, even if it's only going to be there for a couple of historians. But if I hadn't done that, which I did recently, about the same time this other movie came out, it wouldn't exist. And so I feel like that's also part of our process, as you just said, is to be able to provide for others information that allows them to know more about the world we all live in. And that was really important, as those three books are doing that from these brilliant filmmakers. This particular is doing that from this incredible moment in American history.
Are you able to articulate the most important thing you've learned from your interviews with these legendary directors?
You know, I actually thought about this. I literally thought about this right before we started. I thought, and I was pulling out one of the books to see, get a good quote. And I realized there's so many of them that there are a couple things that do stand out. And one was from a French director, and he literally said, curiosity. And that really sort of stopped me, because it just keeps you alive by wanting to find out more about the human beings you're working with, about the story and the situation you're telling. So that one idea of curiosity stands out. And the other one actually came from another director who said, experiment. Take chances. And I also thought that was also something really good, because oftentimes we sort of do what's already been done. And he, and actually Marty Scorsese was on that stage with him as well, both of them were sort of pushing out that idea of explore, and discover new things and literally take chances. Walk that razor's edge, and who knows what's going to come out of it. So those two things, I think, are standing out as of last night. But ask me tomorrow, and I'm going to have a whole bunch of other quotes as well.
Well, those two lessons are applicable to any industry, any endeavor. So I love that. They're very universal. Is there a director who's no longer with us that you would like to have interviewed?
Oh, that's a powerful thing. I think there's so many people I would
Eisenstadt?
Like. Eisenstein for sure, but I was thinking, I'd like to actually talk to Abe Lincoln. I realize he's not a filmmaker, but I kind of like, I wouldn't mind talking to Moses. I'd be a little intimidated, but if you're going to be that close to God, I kind of would like to know what that's about. You know, I had this near-death experience, and what it told me was that consciousness itself never ends, which is an incredible sort of idea, because you think, death is the end of everything, unless you have issues of heaven and hell. But what really doesn't end is consciousness. So if consciousness doesn't end, how do we become, as we're alive, more conscious? There's this line that really stuck with me, which was, also about the issue of mortality, because you ask, who would I talk to who's no longer here? And maybe even my father and my mother. How about that? I've got questions that I would like to ask both of them. Maybe you have the same thing with your parents that I never got to ask them. I'd kind of like, how did you feel about that? We never talked about that. But this line that really stuck out to me was, if one dies before one dies, when one dies, you don't die. Now, the idea behind that is consciousness itself never ends. We are born with it and into it. If we're lucky enough, we focus on what it really is, so that we're aware of others, aware of our environment, aware of this incredible, awesome space that we actually live in, and are conscious of it, and therefore don't destroy it, and aware that in fact this is part of a journey. As I said, I think this is schooling. We're in our human bodies and our brains to learn, and one of the things to learn is that it's not just about us as individuals or as a species. It's about the entire consciousness of a planet, if not the consciousness of the cosmos. So,
well, just for any of our viewers who are not familiar with Jeremy Kagan's book, My Death, A Personal Guidebook, which you see on the screen behind him, this is a book about a near-death experience that Mr. Kagan experienced at a sweat lodge. He says he went to his own version of hell, and then somehow, Jeremy, you were in blissful ecstasy of perfection, which you described as absolute joy and serenity, with the most complete feeling of love you've ever experienced. So I highly recommend that book. to our viewers, because it's a very different Jeremy Kagan than the Jeremy Kagan who talks about his movies. Now, I want to ask you, Jeremy, you started out in Hollywood in the early 70s, and you've seen a lot of changes in the movie and TV industry over the years. How do you feel about the state of the industry at the present time?
It's very different than it was when I was able to enter it. So there's, like everything, change is what is. So the industry obviously has changed. One of the things that's true about the industry is it's about profit. It's about making money. Now, it's using art to make money, but it's about making money. And that hasn't really changed. But the people who are making decisions as to what they think is going to make money, some of them are less, I'll use the word, in love with the very form of cinema. It's, you know, we got cinema and we've got the, the parks, and the parks are making more money than cinema. So let's invest more in the parks. And the confidence of doing something experimental and new, that's risky. Why don't we make something that we've already made? Because that made money. Maybe if we remake it, it's going to make money. And oftentimes it does. But what happens is you get what's called tentpole movies, meaning we already know what's there and it's repeated. Listen, escapism in terms of entertainment, obviously I'm a socially conscious human being, socially conscious filmmaker, but I like to laugh. I don't like to get scared. I'm sorry. The horror movies, that's a genre that really works with me. Therefore, I'm not really fond of it because it scares me. But the point is that, something that is totally entertaining, taking my mind off of a problem and taking me into another world, I'm delighted. So to be entertaining is, in fact, I think, essential. Even if you have, in quotes, a message, tell it in a way that people really get involved in the story. But Hollywood now, and it's sort of fascinating when you look at the history of Hollywood, as I know you have, you look at sort of companies like Warner Brothers in the 30s and 40s, making, really political, socially responsible movies. Now, and some of them made money. So that's what they did, and others did dance movies, and MGM did those kind of movies. And what we're seeing now with the shrinking of sort of the Hollywood, let's go to the theater companies, is that we're seeing less, I would say, original material that sometimes shows you a new way of being and thinking and feeling. Independent filmmaking, great. But how do those independent films get out there? And very few of them do. Even though it's very easy now to make a movie. I mean, in the sense, you get a cell phone and your computer and a couple of good actors, and you can go make a movie. So that's fabulous. And that's different than it's ever been. But for that movie to be seen is very difficult. And because there are these endless streaming possibilities and these endless channels, yeah, they're niches and all the rest, but it's also incredibly different. So in a way, there's more opportunity to make things, but a greater difficulty in getting them necessarily seen. That, I think, is almost always the challenge that filmmakers today have that is different from the past. So that's one of those two issues. I mean, but the issue, again, of the major companies has always been about money.
I want to tell our viewers that you can learn more about Jeremy Kagan by going to his official website, thenearDeathandLifeofJeremyKagan.com. Well, Jeremy, I only have one more question for you. Are you ready?
If I can be.
After filming Rosewell, which was based on a true story, do you believe in UFOs?
Absolutely. I believe there is consciousness, using that word now, consciousness of outside our experience as human beings, that there is also consciousness. What form that takes is fascinating in the sense that when we say we're seeing aliens or we're seeing aliens crafts or whatever that is, in many ways, that's our minds being able to deal with and sort of concretize something that is outside any of our experience. So in a way, we create the aliens like all of our movies are creating aliens. I remember Steven Spielberg calling me up and saying, how did you create the alien in Roswell? And I said, Steven, my movie cost what, you know, what E.T. is. What are you talking about? He said, yeah, but it's a different version. I hadn't seen that. How did you do that? Okay. So my point is that we create these images. But I think what probably is real is we are sometimes in, even now, in communication, whether it's in dream world or other ways of being aware, with consciousness that is beyond the limits of what we feel is, in fact, real right now. So therefore, yes, I believe there is consciousness that communicates to us. But in a way, it's like one time someone said something so powerful to me. He said, well, there's not just one universe. What? And apparently physicists talk about this. There are universes, multiverses. And what the issue is, that is, it's not the sense of time and space that we are used to, because that's what we're used to, time and space. That's how we live. It in fact transcends time and space. It's beyond time and space. So therefore, it's not about a spaceship coming from way over here to way over here. That's a good story. That's all right. It's instantaneous. It's right here, right now. Now, people who see ghosts and paranormal experiences, in many ways, that's a similar thing. Are they not there? Is it all fake? I don't think so. I think we're young in being able to understand and be aware of and even communicate and accept the communications of a much greater consciousness than time and space and our way of seeing and hearing.
Well, Mr. Jeremy Kagan, it's been such a tremendous honor meeting you, having this opportunity to chat with you about your amazing life and your career. Thank you so much for taking the time to appear on our show.
It's been a privilege. Thank you for taking the time. Thank you specifically for taking the time. And thank anybody who takes the time. I hope there's something in this time that is of value to you.
I have no doubt of that. Our guest has been the internationally acclaimed director, producer, author, and educator, Jeremy Kagan. My name is Harvey Brownstone. Thank you to my producer, Steve Silver, my director of programming, Deborah Batsafin, my production assistant, Rosa Puzo, my PR director, Laurie Towers, and my entire team at the XPTV One Network in the UK. Thank you all for joining us. See you next time.
Thanks for watching. Be sure to check out all the great interviews on the Harvey Brownstone Interviews YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new videos are posted.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit leafhome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as one day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. LeafHome.com/water.